Welcome to Decoding the Customer, a podcast about customer experience and how to realize customer-centric change in today's dynamic business world. I'm Julia Ahlfeldt, certified customer experience professional, business advisor, and your host as we explore topics, trends, and best practices that are enabling brands to thrive in the age of the customer. Thank you for tuning in. If this is your first time listening, welcome. If you're a regular listener, thank you, and it's great to have you back. This is episode 26. The first of four weekly episodes for the month of February. As the year gains momentum and business plans start to take shape into reality, I wanted to take this month to feature inspiring thought leadership from some of the top customer experience thinkers from around the world. I'm starting things off with an interview with Adrian Swinsko, best-selling author, business advisor, Forbes contributor, fellow podcaster, and CX aspirant punk, in his words. Adrian and I caught up at the Customer Experience Innovation and Tech Fest in Pretoria late last year to explore the precarious balance between humans and technology in customer experience. Adrian shares his insights on how to find that balance, makes the case for human intervention as a value add, and explores how brands can benefit from exposing their vulnerability. If you want to make sense of how tech innovations fit into customer experience strategy, then this episode was made for you. For more information about this episode, including links to Adrian's website and podcast, which I highly recommend, check out my website, julia-ahlfeldt.com or decodingthecustomer.com, where you can also check out previous episodes or subscribe to the show. This month, I'm going to be bringing you customer experience thought leadership from around the world. But for those who really want to turn up the dial on their CX knowledge base and learn more about customer experience management, then I'd encourage you to check out CX University. CX University has long been a supporter of the customer experience profession, and I'm proud to have them as sponsors of this episode. CX University offers a fantastic array of online courses, CCXP practice tests, webinars, instructor-led training, e-learning, and custom modules. CX University is a Customer Experience Professionals Association authorized resource and training provider, meaning that their materials have been reviewed and vetted by the Customer Experience Professionals Association for alignment to the six core competencies that are in the CCXP exam. And CX University also provides the option to earn six college credits through their courses. They have a flexible and affordable monthly subscription model and have offered an exclusive discount to listeners of this show. Listeners can use the code PODCAST10 to get 10% off your first month subscription. So thank you to CX University for your support. And with that, let's dive into today's show. In a world where we're spending increasing amounts of time on our phones and electronic devices, and the digital world has infiltrated nearly all aspects of our lives, it can be easy to fall prey to the mantra that tech is best, but that simply isn't always the case. Definitely not in the field of customer experience. Yes, technology can be an incredible enabler of great customer experience. From tech solutions that help businesses decipher customer feedback, to algorithms that recommend products, to social media platforms that help consumers keep businesses accountable, there's no denying that technology has turbocharged many aspects of customer experience. But it doesn't mean that the human element has lost its place or that technology is always the right answer. That's just not true. Yet, with the drumbeat of news about innovations, AI, blockchain, chatbots, and so much more, it can be difficult to navigate the balance between adding those which truly enhance the experience and not stripping away the human element, which makes some experiences special. My guest for this episode, Adrian Swinsko, has made this topic the feature of some of his recent writings and talks. Before we met at the conference in Pretoria, he published an article exploring the idea that so many experiences have swung in the direction of automation that being powered by humans is kind of becoming a thing. This resonated strongly with me, as I've seen many organizations push customer experience or back office automation to the point where it erodes customer experience. Sometimes the motivations for this are genuine, and in other instances, this is driven by the pursuit of cost cutting. But in any case, negative experiences will eventually drive customers away. And as customer experience professionals, we are in pursuit of strategies that do just the opposite. So the time is ripe for us to unpack this topic and find the tech-human balance. Adrian is well positioned to provide insights on this topic. He has been growing and helping develop customer-focused large and small businesses for over 20 years. He previously worked with Shell, the Financial Times, and the Economist Group, and has advised and consulted to numerous organizations around the world, including ITV, HarperCollins, Microsoft, Pearson, and Costa Coffee, just to name a few. As these leading brands have been considering options for their customer experience evolution, Adrian has been there to provide insight and keep his finger on the pulse of customer experience excellence and what's keeping business leaders awake at night. One of the things that I really liked about Adrian is that he doesn't beat around the bush. With more tech jargon swirling around by the day, Adrian's frank and honest approach is just what's needed. I hope that you enjoy our conversation.
So my name's Adrian Swinsko. I am an independent advisor, author, Forbes contributor, jack of all trades, master of none, investigator, explorer, troublemaker, all these things, I guess, depending on who you talk to, with a focus on spaces like customer service, customer experience. But the thing that I'm really interested in is how do we build organizations that produce better outcomes for both their customers and the people? That's my primary focus.
It's really great to have you here, bringing your thought leadership to the South African customer experience scene. I mean, we're still relatively new in the customer experience world here. It's a couple of years younger than it is in a lot of established markets. So it's really nice to have some global thought leadership joining us here to share wisdom.
You're making me blush now. Stop it. But thank you. I will take it. My mom will be proud.
No, but really, it's cool. It's great to have you come in.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. So you recently wrote that being powered by humans is becoming a thing. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by that?
I first wrote about whether it's time for us to consider or reconsider the human-tech balance and how we deliver service and experience. I think it was back in the middle of 2016. And it's just something that's been on my radar, been sort of spotting. And what we've seen is that we've seen a lot of people not getting things right. They've been going down the technology, digital solution, self-service, that sort of stuff, automation, AI, blah, 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 blah. And a lot of people, particularly customers, have been increasingly saying that they're just not happy with what they're getting. I mean, they're happy to self-serve and help themselves, but some of the digital tools and this new technology is just not working for them, and they're not living up to expectations. And when things get complicated, it feels like companies are just making it really hard for them to actually reach out to somebody, a human being who has the tools and the skills and, you know, and the wherewithal to help them solve the problem. So it's a bit like having a fire in your house sort of thing. You might have a fire extinguisher and a fire blanket and all these different sort of like kind of things. But when it gets slightly out of control, you want to kind of call emergency services and you want somebody to pick up and send around a big fire truck, right?
Yeah.
And put out the fire. And it's all that, almost like feels like that's what customers are experiencing. Is like, when we've got these tools and we're trying to kind of put out these fires for ourselves and things. But then sometimes when it gets a little bit out of control, we get a bit scared sort of thing. We want to press that. Either whether it's 911 in the States or 999 in the mm-hmm. UK or whatever the number might mm-hmm. be, and somebody picks up and goes, yes, we're on our way sort of thing. And yeah. then they send everybody, and that's your emergency service or like response. But people want that, but they don't seem to be getting it. And that sort of frustrates me. But then going back to your original question about is power by humans becoming a thing, what was really interesting is that we start to see people saying that the human connection is becoming increasingly important. But we're not necessarily seeing a huge amount of evidence around this. But then back in August of this year, John Legere of T-Mobile, CEO of T-Mobile USA, came out and went, we've been testing this thing. The thing is people,
yeah.
right? We built this network of team of experts. So we're getting rid of all of our chatbots and our autobots and, you know, other Transformer-esque things and their IVRs and everything else. And we're like going, we're going to build a distributed team of experts that are going to sit in cities around the US who, when you call, you'll get routed to one of your local experts. And they'll just pick up the phone and they're equipped with all of the best tools.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like AI-enabled, blah, 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 fancy gadgets.
Yeah.
But it's humans that are enabled by really, really, really useful technology. But people can automatically get through to somebody who is an expert that is equipped with all the right sort of tools who can help you solve your problem kind of straight away. They've been building this and testing this for like 2 years now. and just launched it. Now, they're the third biggest kind of wireless carrier in the US, and they like to do things that are different and go their own way. But in their testing, this is the really interesting thing, the testing, when they test it against their standard service, which is a team of experts, there's a plus 55 MPS differential between the two propositions.
Yeah.
I'm like going, why wouldn't you?
And I was reading about this too. It looks like their team of experts was actually costing them less than trying to route through all of the automated stuff and having the queries land with an agent and then shuffled around between agents and the call time, and all of it was so much more expensive than just having a team of experts be able to deal with the problems sort of one and done quickly, which flies in the face of the traditional perspective on business process outsourcing and call centers where you want to try and automate as much as possible. So not only did it improve Net Promoter Score, but it really challenged the established knowledge of
how you because actually what it shows is that just because you add more process to something or more industrialization or more mechanization or more technology or anything else in this vainglorious quest for efficiency, that actually that you're going to get what you set out to do is of like more is going to achieve more. Mm-hmm. And actually sometimes you get to a certain point, it's a bit like having a lemon, so you can only get so much juice out of it. And regardless if you squeeze harder, you're not going to get any more juice out of it.
Yeah.
And sometimes to take the next steps requires you to do something different. And I think what's interesting about what they've done, they've probably stepped back and they've taken a bit more of a systems view of things mm-hmm. and gone, well, actually, rather than actually thinking about how do we help people self-serve and put them through all this kind of technological kind of maze, why don't we just solve the problems at the point of demand? And why don't we do that at the most fastest and the most efficient kind of way that we can do that? And in their sort of thinking, they've come to a proposition which goes, and that's not just about technology. Actually, that's about human beings. And that's actually what matters. Because mm-hmm. people want help. They want help that is fast and is knowledge and is personal. And that's human beings. But human beings that are highly trained, very capable, very knowledgeable, and equipped with all the right sort of tools. And you look at it and just go, well, why wouldn't you? It does feel kind of counterintuitive in terms of that kind of production line, industrial economic sort of view of the world. But actually, that's what makes it really smart and really brave, because they've done something different, but they're just kind of looked at with no biases and looked at what's the best way of doing things.
Yeah.
And they've gone, this is the experience that we want to create. Okay, what's the best way to deliver that?
Yeah.
And they're not making any assumptions that it's tech first or human first or process first or whatever it means. It's like, this is the experience that we want. Now, what's the best way to deliver that?
It seems to me like they've solved a customer problem the best way that it needed to be solved, not solving a business problem first. So. Yeah.
And the great thing about it is that, I mean, the challenge that they have is because they're, the third biggest.
Mm-hmm. They used to be like the fourth or fifth. I mean, they've been growing
quite
a lot. They're an interesting success story.
Yeah, they're doing, and it's like one of those markets which is, you know, insanely competitive. And what they're showing is like, they are competing and growing their market share by doing brave things, even an ultra competitive kind of market. Mm-hmm. And actually, they're showing that that's what it takes if you want to do that, even in ultra competitive kind of markets. So you can't discount your way or cost cut your way to success. Sometimes you have to play a bigger game.
Yeah.
But then they've got a CEO, John Legere, who's like, he's all about playing big games and he's all about paying the attention. But that's, to me, that's what's required to do that. So in all of the round sort of thing, that's kind of why I think when you get a large super tanker like T-Mobile USA going, ta-da, we're doing this, that's the sort of thing that moves the needle on the market or in terms of the attention that you give a particular strategy.
Yeah.
And that's why I ask the question, is powered by humans going to become a thing?
So how can organizations make sure that these strategies are customer-led or even just strategy-led and not tech-led? Because we're here at the CX Innovation and Tech Fest.
Yeah.
So it is supported by many of the tech providers in the space, which are a really important part of the customer experience ecosystem.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, they play a really important role in things. But I think there's an acknowledgement broadly that it's better to have strategies that are customer-led rather than something that is tech-led, and then you kind of mold the rest of it around that. Yeah. How can businesses make sure that they don't put the cart before the horse, that they do things in this?
Thank you, and it's a good question. One of the central points I was making yesterday when I was talking about this was this idea that I think that many companies and brands, they have a strategy, but then it's a business and commercial sort of strategy. But then if you ask them, so what's your service or experience strategy? They sort of don't really know. And now I was thinking about that in the context of the human versus tech balance idea. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about, well, you know, a way of thinking about it is to think about if you ended up with a graph and you said on one axis, it goes from low touch to high touch. And then on the other axis, it goes from low tech to high tech. You end up with this kind of positioning where if you end up, imagine it's a cross and you end up with four segments. Well, you end up with a high tech, low touch. You have, you know, high tech, high touch. You have low tech, low touch. And then you have low tech, high touch. And it gives you sort of almost like personas and positions mm-hmm. and things. And that's sort of a way of people thinking about, okay, well, what is your strategy? Where are you now? And you might be in one of those quadrants, but that doesn't mean to say that your strategy should be fixed. But it's being honest about where you are now and then also where you want to be. Do you want to go more tech? Do you want to go more kind of touch? And how do you want to change? What's the roadmap for that? But it's actually being honest about where you are. But also kind of thinking about how the nuances kind of change, because it's actually that balance and that, if you like, persona may actually kind of change depending on your different customer groups and how that might change what they might need across different parts of their journey.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of a multi-layered, very sophisticated sort of approach. But I think that's what's required to deliver the results, because otherwise it feels like we're slapping on the tech paint and hoping for the best.
It's almost like everybody's trying to move into the tech half side of the quadrant, regardless of whether or not that's what's right for,
well, exactly.
for them. You know?
I think you're right. I think there's almost this, it feels like people are kind of going after this nirvana of everything's automated and mm-hmm. things. I'm like going, but despite the evidence that people don't want that.
Yeah, there are times when you just want to speak to a human. Mm-hmm. To your point, when the house is on fire, you just want to pick up the phone.
I want to see a farmer.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I don't want to see a robot show up. I want a human, you know?
And things will change in the future, and our preferences will change in the future. But we don't live in the future. We live now.
Yeah.
Because you compete now. Your customers buy from you now. They don't buy from you in the future. So it's actually dealing with them and what's real for them and what's important to them right now. I think that one of the biggest kind of missing pieces is that many organizations don't have a view on what is their experience mm-hmm. strategy. What are they trying to build? Because if they had an understanding of what they wanted to try and achieve, then they'd be able to make better choices around this sort of data that they need to support that, and then the sort of technology they need to support that, and also kind of where the human touch comes in to support that. And then you end up figuring out kind of what the balance is, because actually you know what you're pitching for.
Yeah.
Right now, I don't think there's many people know what they're pitching for. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just a blind spot. I hope it's just a blind spot. Or is it they just haven't done the thinking?
Or the research to understand what customers want. Can organizations play in multiple quadrants? So could you be a brand and say, some of our experiences are high tech, high touch. Some of our experiences are low tech, low touch. Or as a brand, do you need to pick an area of that quadrant layout that you want to play in?
I think there's some combinations that are probably not going to work as well as like, so a low touch, low tech, kind of a, almost an old school kind of grocery market type thing, picking oranges from cardboard boxes mm-hmm. instead of helping yourself. And a high tech, high touch combination, that's probably not going to work. It's like two ends of the extreme. But that doesn't mean to say that you couldn't have something, a portfolio of offers. They range from high tech, high touch, all the way through to high tech, low touch, mm-hmm. depending on who your customer group was.
Yeah.
Let's say you take something like financial services, mm-hmm. for example, and you might have somebody that is a consumer, they're more digitally savvy, digitally inclined than are, and they're like, going, I don't want to speak to the bank. I want to do everything on my phone via my app sort of thing. Everything's self-service. My needs aren't complicated. I'm totally cool with that. You're like, going, fine, rock on. Okay. Yeah. And then there's other kind of people that are going, yeah, I like the kind of the bits and pieces, but I've got more complicated sort of financial needs, or maybe I just got more complicated sort of personal kind of needs that I want to talk to somebody. And therefore I want to book an appointment to see somebody, and that might be through a secure video screen so you can do it remotely, or it might be that you end up arranging an appointment to see somebody in a bank mm-hmm. somewhere or an office or whatever, but that would work for them.
Yeah.
And I think it's being smart about some of these things and understanding that you don't have to be all in one and not in the other. It's like you can actually have the variation, and he also could give people the flexibility to swap between one and the other, or you make it different offers. You go, here's a high tech, low touch offer, and oh, by the way, if you do it this way, then it's purely self-service, and maybe the access to a human being is not as easy to do because you've done the profiling of those customers so well that you understand the likelihood of that happening is very, very small. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of sculpt that offer appropriately to their needs. Now, you'd like to think they'd have people that were on demand as and when, mm-hmm. but the likelihood of that happening is kind of very small. So, okay, fine. But then there's other ones where you go, well, actually, it's more likely they're going to want to talk to people and have fast access to things. And you structure the economics of that accordingly. And those two things aren't mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
You just need to be clever about how you can work that stuff out.
Yeah. I think for a lot of organizations, it's daunting to think that, right, we need to offer all of these different kinds of experiences. And
or you know, you don't, and you choose, and you choose not to kind of offer certain things. And there's another thing I was talking about yesterday, is that the idea of, like, you know, this proliferation of channels and mm-hmm. things. And isn't it marvelous when you think kind of like, well, the power that comes with being able to say no or choosing not to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think what we're seeing is we're seeing people are adding and adding and adding channels to try and think about, we need to be in all these places where customers are. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. But actually, what you end up doing is you end up basically averaging your resources out across more and more channels, which means you end up with a thinner coverage. You end up being either average or mediocre at a lot of things rather than great at a few. And I would like to see more brands decide to choose to focus on fewer channels and being great at those, and then relying on the attractiveness of greatness. Then people will come to you because they know they're going to get the thing that they want. You can start to minimize this channel shift sort of idea where people are switching back and forth between kind of channels because they're probing around looking for where I'm going to get the best service.
Yeah, where's the first contact resolution going to happen? Is it going to be through the chatbot? Is it going to be through the contact center? Where is it going to be in there?
And they're like, I just wanted some help, right?
Yeah.
But if you go, well, if we do less and we pile all our resources into that and just do a better job in fewer channels,
mm-hmm.
then actually hopefully you'll get better results. You should get better results. And actually that in itself should be attractive to your customers.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like rocket science. But it's hard. It's organizationally hard. From a human being's perspective, it's hard because it requires us to say no to things
mm-hmm.
and to choose to stop doing stuff. That can be really difficult. It's easy. We love adding things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like we think about it from a very personal perspective. Many of us are probably enthralled or attracted to this idea of minimalist living sort of thing. It's a kind of more Scandinavian style of kind of living. But we can't take away from the idea that we still buy more stuff than we need and we have all this clutter.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, but getting rid of stuff is hard.
Yeah.
Because we have all sorts of attachment issues to things.
And I think sometimes in the business world, there's this sort of like innovation FOMO, you know, fear of missing out. So in the boardroom, people are like, should we have an app? Maybe we should have an app. If we don't have an app, everyone else is going to, our competitors are going to, you know. So it's this fear of missing out and fear of being left behind that drives these decisions.
Yeah.
And you've got to balance that with, right, okay, let's pay attention to what our customers want. And you know.
Oh, yeah, because it's that sort of thing about fear of missing out and the idea that the consequence that comes of that sort of thing is like if they don't do the things that they say they're going to do, like make their numbers sort of thing, then because they haven't done a certain thing, so somebody turns around and goes, oh, it's because you didn't have an app. Like, well, no, that's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
But they don't want somebody to point and say, oh, it's because you said no to that sort of thing. So it's like this idea of like being wrong sort of thing. We talk about this kind of rhetoric that goes around businesses and particularly tech businesses and startups and things, but the organizations are starting to think about this, about being more agile in the way that we do things. We talk about learning and failing fast and stuff. Most people are not interested in failing. The best question you could ask a senior exec kind of recently is like, when was the last time you failed at something? I mean, really failed at something. And then listen. And I'll bet you get hit with deafening silence.
And there are sort of cultural overlays with that too. So I'm originally from the United States. I've been working here in this market for a while in South Africa. And in the American market, I think there's more acceptance around failure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the case everywhere else. And so then that just sort of piles on top of this inability to move forward or make decisions or, you know.
Yeah, so I mean, I think even though the talk in the States might be, and the culture, it might feel a bit more amenable or accepting of the idea of failing sort of thing, I think that's dominated by this huge tech wave.
For sure.
That's kind of coming out of, you know, not just Silicon Valley, but Boston, Massachusetts kind of way, and also like Salt Lake City and Vegas and all over the place, because you've got tech hubs that have been up all over the place, which is amazing. But it dominates the kind of media and the headlines and the kind of industry commentariat and everything else. And it becomes propaganda in itself. The more people talk about it, the more get it, and they see people doing it and they talk about it. But yet, even in the US, they're still plagued by some of the same results in terms of, like, you know, those stats that show that 70% of all CX and digital initiatives are failing to meet their primary objectives. Mm-hmm. They're all failing to deliver. And so we're not learning enough. We're not learning fast enough. We're not failing fast enough. We're trying things. We're trying to transform everything and looking for the answer. You're like going, well, there is no answer.
Yeah, there's not a single answer.
No.
There are many different answers.
There's answers for all sorts of different sort of people, but there is no, like, one-size-fits-all. There's no super pill.
There's no blueprint.
Yeah, no, this is not the Matrix. Yeah. This is not a blue pill, red pill sort of, like, kind of moment. It's a case of, it's your journey. It's your task. It's your challenge to go plot your own path. But I think you're right in terms of that it feels that in America is that it's more accepting because there's more conversation about that, and we see people build things and then they don't succeed, and they build things and don't succeed, and so that it becomes more familiar, which is kind of different to perhaps countries like South Africa and or maybe kind of like the UK, where the very early days and their understanding of what that means and what it means to fail, and that links to, you know, political and societal conditions and how precarious kind of things are economically. And it's the same as true in Britain, is that we'll talk a good game, but we're not interested in really making mistakes, not that much. But here's the fascinating thing, and this is the counterintuitive thing, I think, is in many ways, customers are waiting for companies to try things.
Yeah.
And there's an interesting psychological bias that's called the pratfall effect. It was first spotted, I think it's by an American psychologist called Isaacson, I think, did this experiment where he invited his friend along to do a pub quiz type thing. He gave him all the answers beforehand. So he came along and he filmed this kind of quiz thing. And his friend got 90% of all the answers kind of right. So his friend got up and kind of walked away from the quiz table. And as he was walking away, he stumbled and spilt like a cup of coffee kind of on himself. So Isaacson had filmed this whole thing and then created two versions. He created one version, which was him answering all of the questions and getting 90% right. That one version. And then the second version was the same, answering all the questions, getting 90% right. But then the bit after where he walked off the stage and he tripped and he spilled some coffee on himself. And he tested this with different groups of people. And overwhelmingly, the people chose the character that they saw getting 90% of the questions right and also spilling coffee on themselves as being more likable, more trustworthy, more believable, and a nicer kind of person.
That's interesting.
Because here's the thing, is that we don't trust perfection.
No, yeah.
We like things to be good, but we also like things to be kind of quirky and real and slightly crinkled at the edges and things. We talk about eliminating our weaknesses, but sometimes we actually kind of need to embrace our weaknesses and go, actually, it's a thing.
Yeah.
And it's a bit, that's what makes us a bit weird. And you sort of have to embrace that because that actually might make you feel kind of more human. If you think about that idea in terms of failing, it's like, we're going to try really hard. We're going to just try some things and they might not work. So stuff.
Yeah.
That might be a way to endear yourself to your customers.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff out there right now about this servant leadership style where you're a leader, but serving your employees and serving your customers and turning leadership on its head and saying, right, leadership is actually about being humble and vulnerable. So I think that speaks to what you just,
said. Completely. But I think within all of that, I mean, servant leadership has been around for a long time, but I think it's never really taken a huge hold in the private sector, commercial sort of environments. you've seen a lot of success, a lot of people doing it in public service, in academia, in healthcare, that sort of side of things. And also in military services and stuff, where you can say, yeah, that makes sense, because you're in the services or in some sort of service. But it's never really kind of taken hold, I don't think, as much as it could and should do in the private and commercial sector. And I think there's an interesting dynamic that people need to be clear about, is the idea about our relationship to the word service and what it means to serve. And also to those people that work in service and service-related positions. And I think it's interesting and challenging for many, because some people see those positions as being lower. They don't want to be in those positions because they see them as being somewhat subservient. And I think we have to challenge that thinking, because we're all in service to somebody or someone or something. And we have to get okay with that. Because if we don't, then we're playing a zero-sum game. And it's like, I'm better than you. We're like, well, no, we're all connected. We're all trying to do better things. And I think there's honor and there's pride and there's value and there's art and there's respect and all these good things that are in service positions. And if we can just get to the point where we see that, we hold that, and we kind of cherish that, we nurture that, then we can do wonderful things. And then we then truly become those servant leaders that we kind of talk about.
Establishing this service without subservience is challenging in different environments. And in an environment like South Africa, where you have a massive gap between the rich and the poor, and very often the people who are providing a service don't consume that service themselves, or the business leaders who are making decisions about products and services may not actually be the demographic that consumes those services. So you have this constant pull away between consumers and the people who are providing the service. And businesses have to really try and tie those things back together. There's more of a natural tie where you don't have these massive gaps between the rich and the poor, or a really complicated cultural framework here where you've got 11 national languages. It makes things more challenging in that way.
I think that's a good point. But you end up with people that are very successful. They earn a lot of money. They've got a very senior position, you know, with great responsibility. The people that haven't been as successful, I don't necessarily think they automatically begrudge the success, because as long as they're shown respect. Because it's like, if you work hard for it, then you, and you deserve your success, that's kind of fine. But if you do it with a respectful way, the worst thing you can do to people is ignore them. And so if you have people that are working kind of hard, doing their own thing, and they might be working for you, and they might be in a service position, and it might be a very well-paid service position, or you might be running a company where you're just completely divorced from your sort of demographic, then, but spending time to understand and respect those kind of people, you might not become your demographic, but you can actually show an affinity with your demographic and a respect for your demographic. That goes a long way, because it turns around and says, well, we might be different, but I value you and I respect you and I hold what you want as being important, and I'm going to try my hardest to deliver against that. And if you do that, and you do that right and do it on a regular kind of basis, it means that you stay connected to people and you're willing to make that time and effort to do that. Like, people don't begrudge you success. They're like going, he's like one of our guys. He's done really well. Is it? Look at him. He's brilliant.
But you have to make time for that.
Of course.
For a lot of leaders, it's about, how do I get away from my dashboards and what I think is important and actually dive into what is important, which is...
But all this sort of stuff requires, yes, it requires time and effort and energy, but it, as you rightly said earlier on, it's about vulnerability and it's about emotional labor. And it's like stuff that we're just, sometimes we're not naturally good at. And it's about making ourselves vulnerable to people. And people might go like, you stuffed up, you didn't show up, and where have you been? And all this sort of criticism sort of stuff. It's like, we're not willing to do what it takes.
Yeah.
So it's not true. It's not real. And that's kind of where the rubber really hits the road. It's like going, if you really want to do stuff that kind of matters, then figure out kind of where the real work is getting done. And then the real work is usually not staring at your dashboards.
No, it's usually not in an Excel spreadsheet. The answer is rarely in Excel.
Yeah, exactly. But it's hard work. And I think it's worth the effort and it's worth the journey. And I wish more people would try and figure out how to do more of that sort of work. just make you a better leader. It'll produce a better business. It'll make you a better person.
I mean, we're sort of staring down the barrel of the fourth industrial revolution, and a lot of talk about how machine learning and AI are going to transform the business landscape. That's something that could potentially just drive more of a wedge between businesses and their customers, between leaders and their customers, between leaders and their people. Mm-hmm. How do you think businesses can make sure that that doesn't happen?
It has to be about being conscious, being present, paying attention. All of those things, which is hard when we get caught up in the maelstrom of day-to-day work. And when we get caught up around, or you end up making incremental decisions about, oh, we'll do that, that's interesting. We'll do that, that's interesting. Do that, and you end up kind of creating this Frankenstein's monster sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And like, how do we get here? That requires us to be present and understanding the consequences and the intended and unintended consequences of the decisions that we make. Because ultimately, go back to the point I was making, we have to figure out kind of what experiences that we want to build, what businesses that we want to build and why, what sort of countries and societies and economies do we want to build and why. Because if we don't decide what we want, we'll just get what we get given. And that pretty much is probably going to be suboptimal. And then it's not sustainable. And then people with pitchforks then start showing up at the front door.
Yeah.
And then you know that you're on...
You're in trouble.
You're in trouble.
I think you've just answered my next question, which was how businesses can prevent this sort of fear of how machines might take the jobs of humans. But I think it's probably the same answer that you just gave, which is you've got to be conscientious about what that strategic direction is.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so, you know, there's like a letter or a scenario that was written by a Danish MP as a submission to the World Economic Forum a couple of years ago. And it was talking about this scenario like in 2030. And it was talking about an idea where it's like AI eliminated all sorts of jobs and choices and all this stuff. It's like no such thing as shopping anymore because almost the computer and the algorithms kind of, they know and they predict what I want. So they just kind of, things just show up. Mm-hmm. It's like magic type stuff. And you're like going,
I say something to my Alexa and 2 days later something shows up.
Yeah, exactly. Or I just kind of like, I'm muttering something. Alexa doesn't actually have a name anymore. I'm just muttering something around the house. And it's just like, ta-da, things just appear as if maybe. So like shopping sort of disappears. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of work disappears. And then we're just hanging around and hanging out with people. And the comment was, oh yeah, it's like so much easier and kind of things are taken care of and da-da-da. And then there's a reflection at the end which says, but yet I wonder about those people that don't live in the city that are choosing a different life. Are making different choices, and they are choosing to do shopping. They are choosing the friction of daily life because that's what makes life real and interesting. And I paraphrase a little bit, but it's like those are the sort of things that we have to decide. Is almost a bit like the automated decision making and everything else. I mean, that could be like a utopian sort of thing. If you want that type of utopia, or in say 20, 30 years' time, are you still going to like the fact that you can go down to your local kind of market and pick up an orange that's been grown by the person that's kind of mm-hmm. like serving you and smell it and you get that whole kind of kinesthetic and the full sensory experience mm-hmm. sort of thing? Are you going to want to do those sort of things?
Yeah.
Some people might say, yeah, I think I'm really still going to want to do those things.
Yeah.
Like I'm still going to want to pick up an old book in a secondhand bookshop.
Mm-hmm. Smell it.
And smell it sort of
feel
thing.
The pages.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. Because it becomes real. And it's because there's a different sensory experience from it. Some people are going like, I want that.
Yeah.
And some people are like going,
I want my Kindle.
I want my Kindle. Or, you know what? I'd rather not have cars that are powered by petrol because I don't like going to the petrol station and filling it up because I don't like the smell of petrol.
Yeah.
So I'd rather take that sensory experience away. Mm-hmm. And so having maybe hybrid cars, electric cars or whatever, that'd be kind of cool because then we don't have petrol stations.
Yeah.
But again, it's about making conscious choices about what you want and what you don't want.
I think we're always going to want these experiences that what makes life real, these experiences that make it real and tangible. But now we can pick and choose when and where we want the frictionless experience and where we want to actually engage more deeply with the experience mm-hmm. around us, mm-hmm. which is great for consumers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we'll see how it all kind of like splits out, because it's not just about consumption, it's also about economics and it's about society.
Mm-hmm.
And we will be able to cater to all sorts of different consumers and all sorts of different choices, but it's not just about consumption. I think it's also about society and economics, the structure and all those different things. And I think we also, as businesses, I think businesses as agents in those mixes, we have to become more conscious about the footprint that we are creating and our contribution to that whole picture. And I think that becomes a thing. We're seeing more and more people choosing businesses for not just what they do, but also how they do it and why they do it. And I think that's becoming increasingly important. The challenge with all of that, obviously, is that, and this is because we are our own worst enemy, is that convenience trumps choice every time. And so we have to almost like fight against our natural instincts sometimes. But then sometimes we also have to ask companies to help us with that.
Yeah.
Help us make better choices and do better things.
And younger consumers in particular are quite interested in making sure that they spend money with organizations that have the same values that they do. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be more pressure on businesses to practice what they preach and make sure that what they preach is aligned to the value drivers of consumers.
I think that's absolutely right.
Kind of ethical business would be a bigger thing.
Yeah, just business that's in tune with what people kind of want.
Well, thank you.
My pleasure, Julia. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been really fun.
Good.
Cool.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to my interview with Adrian Swensko. I liked his realistic perspective on not trying to be all things to all people and letting go of the pursuit of perfection. Brands should focus on what they can do well and where they can deliver the best experience. But it's also okay to say no when some technological advances just aren't the right fit for the brand. It's a lot easier to jump on the tech bandwagon than to jump off of it. But I hope my conversation with Adrian has provided some ideas about when and where to do this. If you're enjoying the podcast, I invite you to share the program with others or head on over to iTunes and rate the program. This helps others discover the show. I'll be back next week and every Thursday this month with new CX Mini Masterclass episodes. I'll be featuring top customer experience thought leaders from around the world, so be sure to listen in or subscribe for updates when new shows go live. This episode was sponsored by CX University, a customer experience training company offering a broad array of CX learning options, including the convenience of learning anywhere and anytime with their online program, e-learning modules, and CCXP practice exams. CX University is a CXPA accredited resource and training provider, and they offer a flexible and affordable monthly subscription model. At the time of publishing this episode, course subscriptions started at just $75 per month and include access to CCXP practice exam questions. Listeners of this show can get 10% off their first month subscription by entering the discount code PODCAST10 at checkout. To learn more about my conversation with Adrian, including links to his website and podcast, you can check out the show notes for this episode on my website, julia-alfelt.com or decodingthecustomer.com. If you're looking for help realizing customer-centric change in your organization, please don't hesitate to get in touch. My contact details are on my website, or you can reach me on LinkedIn and Twitter. My handle is @juliaalfelt.